The mossback soared steadily onward. The sky was a ceiling of unbroken azure. The earth beneath was a vast, unending panorama of textured squares and rectangles of all colors and sizes. Mountains reared their snowy peaks on the far horizon. Bridget finally opened her eyes and relaxed her grip on the armrests.
How high are we?
I'd say about 10,000 feet, give or take 100 or 3.
Oh, shit.
Her fingers clamped reflexively down again. Both men had put in plenty of flight time as magistrates, though the Deathbirds didn't have the speed, range, or sustained altitude ceiling of the big cargo carrier. The cockpit door opened, and Dvornich stepped into the passenger compartment. She had slipped the headset down to rest on the back of her neck. She held out several small paper-wrapped wafers.
The cabin isn't pressurized. We'll be climbing to 20,000 feet to get over the mountains and areas of ionization, so you may experience some discomfort. Chewing this gum will help to equalize the pressure in your ears.
Bridget took the sticks, eyed them dubiously, and passed them around to her companions.
What's our flight time, Captain?
About 4 hours, if the weather holds. If it does not, considerably longer.
It would have been faster to use the gateway in Peridolinko. I know the jump code for the unit in the Gobi.
No doubt. But we could not have fit our cargo into it, and Pyotr would have refused to set so much as his little toe inside it.
You've made this run before?
Never. But it's Pyotr's 10th or 11th trip. He's been going to Mongolia regularly for the past year.
So he's expected there?
To some extent. His official reason for returning so soon is to recover the wag you borrowed and left high and dry in the desert. It is military property, after all, and despite the broad powers given to us by District 12, we still must account for equipment. Besides, he's making a delivery as well, and that will allay any suspicions among his customers.
Customers?
Dvornich turned back toward the cockpit, lingering long enough to smile directly at Kane.
Get some rest. The flight is only the first leg of our journey. You and I will have plenty of time to talk later.
I think you made quite the impression on her, Kane. What kind of torture did you say she used on you?
I don't recall saying.
The plane sailed on, gradually gaining altitude, flying high above the cloud-wreathed mountain range. Kane figured the three men in the back were Sverdlovsk's hand-picked crew, men he could trust. He wondered if they even suspected their superior officer was involving them in an unsanctioned op. After a while, stuffiness and pain built in Grant's ears, a lingering after-effect of the shot of infrasound he had been subjected to 3 months before. Unwrapping the stick of gum, he popped it in his mouth, chewing slowly. When saliva softened the substance, an unforgettable flavor of rotten apricots with just a hint of battery acid flowed over his tongue.
Ah, fuck!
He stared at the half-masticated wad he had just spit into his hand. He glowered at it for a moment, then stuck it on the underside of his seat.
Ear pain's better than the taste of that shit for the next 2 hours.
Though the cabin was heated, it was still cold at such high altitude, so they kept their coats on and buttoned. Kane leaned toward Bridget.
We need to go over a few things while we have the privacy.
As nervous as she was, Bridget Baptiste couldn't imagine being able to discuss anything intelligently. Then she considered that the man was trying to keep her mind off her flight-induced anxiety, and she silently thanked him for it.
What do you think is going to happen when we arrive in Mongolia?
I don't know. But I do think the Colonel has some kind of plan that involves us as pawns, not partners. What do you think?
I think the same thing. Don't you find it strange he accepted the story about the Archon so easily?
You didn't expect him to believe you?
I didn't when I first heard it, and it came from the Baron himself. I suspect he found more in those old intelligence files than he let on. Besides, he has yet to ask you anything about Bautu.
I noticed that. I've been waiting.
Well, don't supply information.
Who do you think I am, you?
Kane stared at her for a long moment, his gray-blue eyes going cold.
No, Baptiste. I think that's a safe bet.
With that, Kane slouched down in his cramped seat, closing his eyes, resting his head against the window. Bridget squirmed and wriggled, unable to find a comfortable position.
Was that supposed to happen?
Kane didn't stir, didn't so much as crack open an eye. She thought about apologizing to him for the remark she had just made, and the one the night before regarding his tendency to oversimplify complex matters. She decided he had earned both. Still, she tried to imitate his relaxed posture and found that she could not. The TU-114 plunged on, a dark speck arrowing through the limitless blue sea of sky. Kane and Grant managed to nap, as did a couple of the soldiers. Bridget stayed wide awake and tense. After a few hours, the air became progressively rougher, and the plane bounced and jounced on the turbulence. Scraps of clouds whipped over the wings. Suddenly, the craft lost altitude, dropping like an elevator. Bridget clung to the chair arms, not enjoying the abrupt sinking sensation in the pit of her stomach. The TU-114 cut back its flying speed. Kane roused, looking out the window. The open land below was a vastness of parched grassland that rolled up on the horizon, a brown gold under the late afternoon sun. The shadowy humps of distant crags and rock ridges rose out of the terrain. It was a harsh and bleak land, but not so harsh it couldn't support life. Herds of cattle and sheep grazed on the scrubby grass, and here and there were lines of trees along a blue river that curved around in serpentine coils. The airplane circled a crude, unpaved landing strip, evidently one scraped out of a flat stretch of desert. During its second sweep, Kane saw three dun-colored blockhouses thrusting out of the soil like concrete pimples. Mongolia rushed up to meet them. The big tires bounced over the rough ground. Slowly, the aircraft came to a halt. Soldiers rushed forward from the nearest blockhouse to jam wooden chocks behind the plane's wheels. Other troopers wheeled a stairway toward the passenger door. Grant stood up first, beating Bridget only by a second.
Pretty smooth landing, all things considered. My compliments to the pilot.
Sverdlovsk emerged from the cockpit and twisted the latch on the hatch cover.
I hope you had a comfortable flight.
Your hope is in vain.
Swinging open the door, Sverdlovsk allowed the three Americans to exit the plane first. The wind was very cold, but very clean, blowing off the Gobi. When Ivornich had disembarked, Sverdlovsk ushered them all to one side, out of the way of the group of soldiers swarming onto the field to unload the cargo. The belly doors were already hanging open, and a man drove a forklift toward them, a wooden pallet resting on the prongs. The soldiers quickly began unloading the crates. One of them passed down a sealed leather satchel to Sverdlovsk. Holding it in his right hand, Sverdlovsk directed them across the strip toward the largest of the blockhouses. It looked like a somewhat flattened cube, its dull and featureless surface sporting only one door and one window. As they drew closer to it, Kane noticed a gun turret on the roof. Sverdlovsk nodded toward a low range of hills in the west.
Here comes the local, Chamber of Commerce.
A line of riders mounted on shaggy, squat-bodied horses came at a shuffling trot out of a pass in the foot of the hills. Kane did a quick head count. There were a dozen of the small, powerfully built mounted men. They wore fur hats and bandoliers of bullets and bright garb of wool and leather. Some of them carried long, muzzle-loading rifles slung across their backs, and in their belts were stuck old-fashioned pistols. Grant, the armament expert, saw they were of First World War vintage, but the blasters were well-oiled and tended. Scabbarded at their hips were short, curved swords. They were a bronze-skinned people with sparse facial hair. Ivornich rested a hand on the butt of her holstered Makarov.
How do we deal with them?
Easy. Just act like you're disinterested in them. It's Boro Orolok and his retainers. They escorted me back here after my vehicle went missing. They're very polite, but they don't trust me.
Then we'll have something in common.
The mounted men reined their animals to a halt in a crescent in front of Sverdlovsk and the others and simply sat there on their broad horses, which breathed heavily and blinked at them through long forelocks. The warriors eyed Ivornich, Kane, Grant, and Bridget closely. One man spurred his horse forward. He was heavy-set with a long, flowing mustache threaded with gray. His hair was braided in loops around his ears. His piercing eyes looked down at them, fixing briefly on Bridget. With a faint shock of recognition, she realized he was the same man who had ridden beside the Tushegun that night in the valley. An H&K VP-70 rode low in a gun belt around his waist. He smiled, showing strong ivory-colored teeth.
Yagagad, bulugu ino omtogaga.
What's he saying?
I wish I knew. If I did, Adrian and Davis might not have died.
I told you a Mongol's power of memory is extraordinary. Boro remembers you, despite your rather disheveled condition the other night. He wants to know how you managed to escape.
Does this smelly Tartar speak any other language than this barbaric clucking?
Passable Russian.
Good. Have him speak it, then.
Let us speak my tongue, so that my friends may join in our talk.
As you wish. And let us get out of this son of a whore wind.
In the blockhouse it is warm, and we will have food and drink to allow our tongues to move more freely.
Boro swung down from the saddle. He waved to a pair of younger men to follow him. They were both slightly built and identical of facial feature, wearing the same type of thin, drooping mustache.
Those are his eldest sons, Obergon and Sung, the twins.
How many sons does he have?
4.
Well, I know where Shikir is. What happened to the other one?
You tell me, Baptiste. That's a question Boro intends to put to you, and you had best prepare a snappy answer. He named his third son Batu.
The wardroom inside the blockhouse was a small warren of concrete sunk 12 feet beneath the ground. Sverdlovsk, Ivornich, Brigid, Grant, Kane, and Boro sat around the rectangular table, which occupied most of the floor space. Obergon and Sung took up sloppy parade rest postures in front of the open doorway. Unlike their father, they didn't remove their fur caps, though it was comfortably warm in the room. A clay pot of greasy-smelling yak butter tea simmered on a hot plate in the center of the table. A tray of biscuits sprinkled with gritty brown sugar was placed near Boro's left elbow. Only the Mongol helped himself to the food and drink. He sipped slowly at the tea from a chipped cup, not gulping it as everyone but Sverdlovsk expected. It wasn't proper Mongol manners to guzzle and devour a host's refreshments.
We hold your wag to the valley campsite, Pyotr. It is out of fuel, but undamaged.
Good. I will retrieve it when I bring in this next shipment of material your son requested.
My son, that is, the Tushegun, is still upset that the foreigner escaped. He is even more upset that 5 of his followers were murdered in the sands. He is beside himself with worry about his older brother, Baltu, as all of us are.
Yes, family is very important in this hard land. The clan is all.
Boro's eyes suddenly fixed on Brigid's face.
Jade-eyed woman, who are you? Where do you come from, and where is Baltu?
Brigid contemplated her reply for a long moment, rehearsing her words carefully in her mind.
I am a scholar. I and my comrades come from across the sea, from America.
Ah, yes, I have heard of it. A powerful country, once. A land that was the bitter enemy of both China and Russia. In the old days, before the skies went dark, we also hated the Russians and our own government in Ulaanbaatar, who kissed the Russian bear's ass. We also hated the Chinese and their government in Beijing. We hated a great many people. My forefathers were free nomads who owed allegiance to no one, belonged to no one, and recognized no borders around our country. Now we are nomads again. But my people still hate those who wish to interfere with our way of life, to enslave us to rules and laws and property.
We don't want to interfere or to enslave. We wish to stop the enslavement of people. We don't want war to come again. There has been enough death.
You have answered 2 of my 3 questions. Now answer the 3rd. Where is my son?
Brigid felt perspiration collect on the palms of her hands. She continued to meet Boro's unblinking gaze, aware that Sverdlovsk and Ivornich, who had followed the conversation, were staring at her too. Tension collected around the table like an electrical storm. Suddenly, Kane leaned toward her while smiling politely toward Boro.
What's going on?
He wants to know where Baltu is.
Then tell him exactly what he wants to know. No more, no less.
Where is my son?
Your son is a guest in America, in my home.
You speak foolishness, woman. How did he get from here to your home in America?
Yes, Baptiste. How did he?
It is not easy to explain. We used a device which can cover great distances in a very short time. He was injured, so we took him with us to heal his wounds.
Huh. A device which can cover great distances? Like the air horse in the vault of the Black City?
Brigid exchanged swift glances with Sverdlovsk. He inclined his head a fraction of an inch in a nod.
Yes, like the air horse in the vault. Have you seen it soaring along the winds?
No, it is at rest. The wind has not yet blown strength into it. My son, that is the Tushegun, studies the mystic formulas to restore the wind to it. When will Baltu return to the clan?
When he is healed. When my friends and I return to our home, he will return to his home.
You did not kill him?
No, we did not.
Boro reached for the pot of tea on the hot plate and poured himself another cup.
Perhaps it is just as well he is not here. He has not been the same since he felt the dragon's kiss.
I do not understand.
Boro extended his right index finger.
The Tushegoon wears a dragon here. It is the same dragon worn by Genghis Khan. When it kissed Baotu and others in the clan, he changed. He became cruel. He ignored his father. He no longer heeded or obeyed me. He did only the bidding of his little brother, as if a stripling in a mask would know what is best for the clan.
So you don't believe your son Shakir is an anointed one? You don't believe he is a messiah of your people?
I do not know. At first I believed his claims, or I wanted to believe them. He was always something of a dreamer. But as he spent more time in that thrice-damned vault, tending to the sacred black flame, he changed. I fear for him, and I fear him. He will not allow even me, his father, to see his unmasked face.
And your other sons? Oborgon and Seng? Were they kissed by the dragon?
No. I refuse to allow it. Shakir and I quarreled over it. Seng and Oborgon were born a bit slow-witted, you see. They are addled enough already.
Brigid lifted her eyes toward the twins. Their black eyes glittered at her impersonally.
Can they understand the language we speak?
They can barely understand their own tongue, let alone a foreign language.
Ask them to remove their hats.
Why?
Indulge a foreign custom. Ask them to take off their hats in the presence of ladies.
What are you driving at, Baptiste? They are our guests.
It's a small enough request.
So it is. Oborgon, Seng, Abagatse Malagai.
The twins did not move.
Abagatse Malagai.
Slowly, moving almost in unison, their right hands rose and scraped their fur hats away. Two small marks, a pale bronze against the deep bronze of their wind-burned skins, were visible high on their foreheads. The marks were identical to the one she had seen on Baotu. Boro pushed himself up and away from the table. As he stood up, his son's right hands dropped to their belts and came up gripping duplicate hand blasters, two mammoth Webley MK6 revolvers. Lenya Ivornich clawed for the Makarov holstered at her hip. Flame and smoke gouted from the hexagonal barrels of the pistols. There was no subtlety, no artistry or skill about the murder. The heavy .445 caliber bullets caught her in the center of her chest and the center of her high forehead. Part of her scalp floated away in a crimson haze as she tipped over in the chair propelled by the double impacts. She was very dead by the time she hit the floor. Kane and Grant were in simultaneous motion, reacting with the tensile spring swiftness of men whose lives always depended on their reflexes. Gripping the edges of the table, they overturned it. Pushing the table through the planes of cordite smoke like a flat battering ram, they smashed the table against Oborgon and Seng, sending them staggering through the doorway into the short corridor. Flinging the table aside, Grant and Kane bounded toward the twins. One had fallen down, they didn't know which one, and the other had fetched up against the wall. They still gripped their blasters, and they squeezed off a booming shot apiece. Grant spun around in a half circle as the heavy slug caught him on the left hip, skidding off the Kevlar weave of his coat before burying itself in the doorframe. The impact hurt him, bruised him, but didn't cause serious damage. The round fired from the twin on the floor whipped well over Kane's head, plunging into the wardroom and knocking a saucer-sized crater in the far wall. With his left foot, Kane stab-kicked the man's gun hand, the edge of his boot catching the barrel of the Webley and ripping it backward out of his fingers. Kane's right boot arced up, connecting solidly with the underside of the Mongol's chin. His head snapped up and back, and continued snapping back until it struck the concrete floor with cruel force. Grant hit Oborgon hard, and with concentrated purpose, in the jaw. Then he followed up with blows to the stomach, 1, 2, 3 times in a flurry of left-right combinations. Even as he doubled over, the Mongol tried to bring his pistol to bear, but Grant secured a grip on the long barrel, twisting it toward the ceiling. He jacked his right knee into the Mongol's face. Releasing his grip on the butt of the Webley, the man went over backward, face a mask of blood, falling beside his brother. Kane drew back his foot for another kick, the barely controlled mag instincts in him blazing. But he stopped in mid-motion, trembling with the effort. Neither of the twins was unconscious, but they were too dazed, too foggy with pain to do more than twitch. Boro pushed into the corridor between the panting Grant and Kane.
Sang!
He dropped to his knees beside the man Kane had kicked. Bridget squeezed in, her eyes shining with shock.
What the fuck was that all about?
I asked Boro to tell his sons to take off their hats.
You what? Why?
I wanted to see if they had scars like Bautu in the regions of their temporal lobes. And they do.
Furiously, Boro grabbed a handful of Sung's coat. Sung looked past his outraged father and stared at Baptiste.
You foreigners will not defile our destiny. You will not use us to gain your own ends. The Tushegun will not allow it. Father, you are a pawn of the foreigners. You know the code of the clan. You stand with an outsider. You die with an outsider.
Boro slapped his son open-handed. Suddenly, Sung's eyelids drooped, as if the cuff had put him to sleep. He sagged in his father's hands. Then his eyes snapped wide open, the pupils enlarged, engulfing the irises. There was no emotion in them. His body shuddered, a terrible tremor racking him from the top of his head to the toes of his boots. At the same moment, Obregon convulsed, his own eyes wide and staring at nothing. Boro scrabbled back from them in fear. The twins rolled on the floor, limbs flailing wildly, tendons and veins standing out on their necks and foreheads. Their mouths fell open as if to voice howls, but no sounds came forth. Their hands twitched, fingers curling and uncurling in spasms.
Well, shit, here we go again.
Abruptly, as if power cords had been pulled, Sung's and Obregon's seizures ceased. Their bodies froze in contorted positions, muscles locked. Then, very slowly, they relaxed, settling on the floor. Boro grabbed their wrists, fingered the bases of their throats.
They're dead. Cardiac arrest induced by the implants.
Suicide switches planted inside of his own brothers. The Tushegun is quite the holy man.
Boro took Seng's hand, pressing it between his own, rocking back and forth on his knees. Brigid, Kane, and Grant shuffled back into the shambles of the wardroom. Stepping around overturned chairs and broken pottery, they clustered silently around Sverdlovsk. He sat cross-legged on the floor, cradling Lenya Ivornich in his arms. Her violet eyes were already glazed over, and blood and brain matter dripped from the back of her bullet-blasted skull to the floor. Carefully, using the thumb and forefinger of one hand, Sverdlovsk drew the lids down over her beautiful, blind eyes. He laid her down, arranging her arms and limbs in dignified positions. When he stood, he was dry-eyed, remote of expression.
We're sorry. I liked her.
And I loved her. Success and survival, that's the way to get ahead.
What was she to you? Your lover? Your wife?
What did she would have been? Her death might be a bit easier to bear. No, Lenya was my daughter.
Bridget whirled away, squeezing her eyes shut on tears suddenly springing to her eyes. She had nothing to say. She could think of nothing to say when a man's child had been brutally murdered in front of her very eyes, and there wasn't one thing she had been able to do to prevent it. Not only had she been unable to prevent it, but she knew very well she may have caused it.
Why? Why did they betray me?
Boro and Sverdlovsk, united in grief, watched as troopers placed the corpses of their children in canvas body bags. Kane, Grant, and Bridget stood slightly behind them, shivering as the sun and the thermometer dropped.
All my sons are lost to me.
As is my only child.
Do you blame me, Pyotr?
No, my friend. Nor do I blame Sung and Obregon.
When the body bags were zippered, a pair of Boro's men came forward, leading his son's horses. They heaved the canvas-shrouded corpses of the twins over the saddles, mounted their own steeds, and the entire band slowly rode away toward the hills.
They will wait for me at the camp. I will join them when we have decided what to do.
Sverdlovsk turned away as soldiers carried the bag containing the body of Lenya toward a small outbuilding. Everyone followed him back inside the blockhouse, down the steps to the wardroom. Troopers had conscientiously repaired and cleaned up the damage as best they could. One of them had considerately spread a throw rug over the bloodstain on the floor. Still, Sverdlovsk took a place at the table as far as possible from the spot where Lenya had died. Unlike Boro, he had yet to shed a tear. Kane saw the hard glint in the Russian's eyes and understood why. He wanted vengeance first. A period of mourning would come later. A bottle of vodka sat on the table, but no one seemed interested in it. Sverdlovsk surveyed the faces of the people around him.
Time for total truth among all of us.
You included?
Myself included. Baptiste, what is the significance of the dragon's kiss?
She told him, not deleting or soft-pedaling a single detail, including how Bao Tu had died and the findings of the autopsy. Boro, already numb with shock and grief, didn't react except to reach for the vodka bottle.
There is only one conclusion. The ring worn by the Tushegun is actually some kind of surgical instrument which directly delivers the implant into a subject's, or victim's, brain.
Sverdlovsk quickly translated, and Boro took a swallow of the vodka.
Who would have made such a monstrous thing?
Brigid echoed the question in English.
I think you know, Colonel Sverdlovsk. I think you've always known more about it than you've let on.
You think correctly. There was far more to the report on Kozlov's 1923 expedition to Karo Koto than was ever released, and I read the unexpurgated documents in their entirety. He submitted the theory, with a substantial degree of verification, that a major civilization once existed in the Gobi, predating even Sumeria. The Gobi civilization was said to have been technologically advanced, and the desert upon which it sat was once lush with vegetation. Kozlov hypothesized that the civilization of which Karo Koto was the hub perished due to atomic radiation. Geologists who visited the region later discovered traces of radiation. Evidently, the source of the radiation is in the vault and once more active. Kozlov's theory, which was rejected by his scientific contemporaries, was that the Gobi civilization was created by a non-human race. It was a theory I would have rejected as well, except that I had access to pre-dark KGB records detailing military encounters with so-called flying saucers and entities known as the Greys.
The Archons.
Yes, the Archons. Russian troops occupying Berlin during the close of World War II came across evidence of their alliance with the Nazis. Most of that evidence was on paper, scientific developments geared toward secret weapons, and it was appropriated by the Allies. A deal was struck with elements of the Third Reich's intelligence community to absorb their technological and principal scientific establishment. Thus was born the totality concept researchers, and the Cold War between my country and yours. However, the Stalinist government had in its possession something more substantial than documents. Yesterday, in passing, I mentioned Tunguska. It seemed to have no meaning to you. Except for the nuke cost, it was the greatest explosion of destructive forces ever recorded in Russia. Just after dawn on June 8, 1908, a monstrous fireball was first spotted over the Gobi, scorching its way across the sky. People in southern Russia saw it next, describing it as a huge cylinder, glowing a bluish white. At 7:17 that morning, it exploded over the Tunguska River region in Siberia. People as far as 40 miles from the epicenter of the blast were burned, bowled over, killed by the shockwave. Closer to the river, the devastation was even worse. Acres of forest land and herds of deer were instantly vaporized.
What was it, a meteorite?
Meteors leave craters. There wasn't one. Investigators at the site reported finding unusual pieces of shiny metal scattered around. People and animals within 250 miles of the area contracted a strange disease from which they eventually perished. Of course, the scientists of the day did not recognize the symptoms of rat poisoning. As usual, there was much political turmoil in Russia at that time, and so a thorough examination of the site was not undertaken until the end of World War II, nearly 40 years later. The material found in Berlin was the impetus for the new investigation. At Tunguska, scientists found a canister buried deep within the earth. It was a lifeboat-type contrivance and held three creatures in a form of cryogenic stasis. Only one was successfully revived.
According to the report, it telepathically imparted that their craft had intended to land in the Gobi. Their mission was a search and rescue, but their propulsion systems malfunctioned. The crew raced against time to save their ship, but they lost. A little less than a mile above Tunguska, the craft exploded into oblivion.
What happened to the survivor?
The report was not clear about that, whether Balam died, escaped, or was traded.
Balam? That was its name?
It was the closest approximation the linguists could come up with. Why?
Kane didn't want to address that question at the moment, so he asked another one.
Traded to whom?
Possibly to the U.S. Shortly after the creature was found, the Americans made a discovery of similar creatures, and a relatively intact vehicle in a place called Roswell, somewhere in New Mexico, I think. The implication was that the Americans exchanged some of the technology found in the wreckage of the craft for Balam.
Lakesh had related the Roswell incident, but he hadn't placed particular emphasis upon it, and all of them silently wondered why. It seemed like a seminal event in the course of intertwined Archon and human destiny.
When the situation developed last year in the Black Gobi, I put together what I had read in all of the reports and reached the provisional conclusion that an ancient alien installation existed beneath Karukoto.
And you and Lenya set out to secure it for your own ends, using your positions in District 12 as covers.
It's not quite as mercenary as it sounds. Lenya's mother was from Azachowski, a Mongolian purist by blood, so there is a certain familial connection. She perished about 20 years ago in an uprising in Georgia. Lenya's husband was killed 2 years ago during an attempted insurrection. We sought only to establish a power base for ourselves, far from the continual strife. Of course, to establish such a base, you need power that is outside the control of the Central Council.
But it's within the control of a Genghis Khan wannabe. That hardly seems like an equitable exchange. Either living at the sufferance of an unreliable political system, or beneath the rule of a would-be conqueror.
From what Boros told me, his son's control over the power penned up in the vault may not be absolute.
Boro, who had sat stoically through Sverdlovsk's recounting in English, took a swig from the bottle. Lowering it, he spoke in Russian.
Our people have known about the magic of Karukoto since the reign of Tabun Khan, the Five Kings. But we are not city dwellers, we are hunters, herdsmen, raiders. Sometimes children would wander into the ruins of the Black City. My son, Shikir, was one of them, and no matter how severely I warned him to stay away, he kept returning. You know how headstrong youngsters can be. He was fascinated by the history in its walls. As he grew older, his childish fancy for the place seemed to pass. Then, 3 winters ago, Pyotr asked our clan to seek out and report unusual features in the Black Gobi. He gave us instruments to help in our search.
Sverdlovsk translated the Mongol's Russian words into English.
Boro refers to metal detectors, Geiger and rad counters I gave him.
Sverdlovsk nodded for Boro to continue.
Unbeknownst to me, Shikir used the instruments in the vicinity of Karukoto. He found the entrance to the legendary vault, and he claimed he had found our people's true destiny hidden there as well. He persuaded many of our young men to join him in the explorations. Then, bad things began to happen.
What kind of bad things?
A strange, wasting sickness struck our people, our herds. Many of them died. After I told Pyotr of my son's discovery, he flooded us with tools and food and medicines. He asked us to clear the city and to open the vault.
Boro made an odd pagan sign toward the ceiling.
Would now that my son had been the first to perish of the sickness.
So you didn't know about the radiation inside the vault?
Know that the buried bosom of the Black City spread a poison across our land, our people, our herds? Need you ask? The change in Shikir was gradual. He agreed to Pyotr's deal, but only on the provision that we excavate the city alone in our own way. Shikir spent more and more time, days even, by himself in the vault. Then one day, he emerged, his face and soul masked, wearing the hetman's knot of leadership on his shoulder and proclaiming himself the Supreme Chief. Baltu, my eldest, opposed his brother's arrogant presumption. Then he felt the dragon's kiss and became Shikir's lieutenant. I argued with him, beseeched him to reconsider his loyalty. But Baltu was now a reflection of Shikir, who claimed to be a living reflection of all the great Mongol leaders throughout time. I never quite understood what he meant by that. He said I could not understand because I had no sense of our clan's destiny.
As Brigid translated, Kane knew the Mongol was mixing half-truths with deliberate exaggerations. The man had been in on his son's plan, at least at first, and now he regretted his cooperation. It was easier to pose as a helpless victim of circumstances rather than as a willing conspirator who had been betrayed. The Mongols had given their lives, their devotion, to survive in this hard land. All they knew was what belonged to them and kept at the price of their own blood. And if they could protect their land using the magic weapons of a long-dead ancestor, then so much the better. Only in this bleak Asian wilderness were the primitive needs to shape the future still indulged. Perhaps if civilized man, organization man, hadn't allowed transitory political systems to kill their sense of adventure, their sense of justice, to kill their awareness that all around them was a living, wonderful world, then Earth wouldn't have been such a sitting duck for the Archon takeover.
All right, now we know the backstory. Time to plan how to write Fini to it.
We must enter Karakoto. From this base, it is a half-day's overland travel in the beat.
You're expected, but Shikir is obviously suspicious of you. He won't allow any of your party near the vault.
And he might have been sidling through the implants to his brothers and is aware of everything that happened here.
Unlikely. The implants are designed for psychological conditioning. The deaths of his brothers may be accidental, an unforeseen byproduct of the process.
Boro claimed Sung and Noborgon couldn't speak Russian, but they did. They could have learned it through thought transference.
Even so, it doesn't necessarily follow that Shikir saw and heard everything that transpired through the implants in the twins.
But you don't know. We know damn little about true Archon tech. All the stuff we've encountered so far has been manufactured here by humans, following the Archon specs.
You're right. But we do know that the Archons are psychically anchored to one another by hyperspatial filaments of the mind. But it's a passive link, probably subliminal. It's an evolutionary, organic feature of their brains. The odds of Shikir possessing an artificial equivalent are very, very low, simply because of the difference in our brain structures.
It's still a gamble. I don't like the percentages.
What's another 1%er to us?
Grant returned the grin, though a little sourly. It was a private piece of philosophy between the two men from their long careers as magistrates. Their half-serious belief was that 99% of things that went awry could be predicted and compensated for in advance. But there was always a 1% margin of error, and playing against that percentage could have lethal consequences. Sverdlovsk massaged his eyes with the heels of his hands.
We will do whatever is necessary, but the actual details can wait for a while. Let us rest, have something to eat, and get back together in 3 hours. Boro and I have some things to attend to.
Grant opened his mouth to object, then shut it when he saw the grateful glance Boro cast the Russian. The men needed to deal with arrangements for their dead children's bodies. Boro probably had clan funeral rites to perform, and Sverdlovsk was probably pained by having his daughter simply lie in a body bag in a storage shed. Sverdlovsk stood.
There is a cafeteria in the building across the way. The fare is simple but filling. We will reconvene here at 0900 hours.
Accompanied by Boro, he left the wardroom. After a few moments, Kane and Grant exchanged shrugs, then trailed after them. Brigid left the blockhouse, but didn't follow the men across the compound. She walked slowly in the opposite direction, head bowed against the cold breeze. The night sky wasn't black, since there were few clouds. The constellations wheeled frostily overhead. At the corner of a distant outbuilding, out of the steady wind, she stopped to weep. She hadn't cried for a very long time. She had suppressed the grief over the murders of Adrian and Davis, and the tears she had shed in the Peredelenko Matrans chamber didn't count. They were symptoms of jump sickness, or so she hoped. But she wept tears of guilt over the deaths of Lenya Ivornich, Sung, and Obergon. Her clinical nature, the cool scientific detachment she prided herself on, had completely blocked an understanding of the consequences of her cleverness. This was one time she couldn't pat herself on the back for her ingenuity in ferreting out a concealed bit of data. Her training, her oh-so-special intelligence, had prevented her from calculating the obvious human factor. Kane, despite her criticisms of his lack of tactics, would never have been so strategically stupid. He would have made sure that the twins were disarmed, bound, and gagged if need be, before checking them over. She, on the other hand, had given in to the whim to perform a trick of intellectual sleight of hand to impress the natives. And three people had died violently, unnecessarily. Bridget had no idea how long she stayed there, but finally the tears slowed and cooled on her face. Shivering and sniffing, she pulled back the cuff of her coat to check the time, only to remember that Sverdlovsk had yet to return her kron.
"We've a little time yet."
Kane stepped around the wall and handed her a covered mug of steaming liquid.
"It's some kind of barley soup. The taste isn't so much, but according to Emil the chef, it's nutritious. Good for their tissues."
Bridget accepted the mug gratefully, removed the cover, and sipped at it. Warmth slowly spread through her.
"How long have you been there?"
"Just a few minutes. It's too cold for anything longer. Look, it wasn't your fault, Baptiste."
"I should have been smarter. More careful. I knew about the implants, didn't I? Knew what had happened to Baotou?"
"You aren't responsible for what the Tushigun, or whatever his name is this week, did to them. You can't be held accountable for what the boys did to Lenya, either."
"It's not a happy life, is it?"
"Not today. Maybe later."
"Later? Will there be any more of later to be had?"
"I've never thought about it."
"Aren't you afraid you'll run out of laters?"
"Of course I'm afraid. But I put that fear behind me, because there's nothing to be gained from it. And nothing to be gained from guilt, either. You hear me, Bridget?"
She looked up at him quickly, peering through the steam rising from the mug.
"I think that's the first time you've called me by my first name."
"Is it?"
"You didn't realize?"
"I say a lot of things I don't realize or mean, as you've had occasion to point out. You done with that mug? If so, I'll take it back."
"Yes. Thanks, Kane."
"You're welcome, Baptiste."
The sheer number of yurts was unsettling. There were at least 1,000 of the yak-hide domes covering the valley floor, sprawling nearly a quarter of a mile or more in all directions. A gray umbrella of smoke hung above the valley, the result of hundreds of cookfires. They were lying on their stomachs on the rim of the bowl-shaped valley, looking down at the tent city in the late afternoon sun. Peering through the eyepieces of a compact set of binoculars, Grant looked beyond the settlement. The thin black line of walls reared from the sands 2 miles distant.
"There it is."
"And there is where we will find the Tushigun. Let us be off. Scouts have already reported our approach, and if we delay further, we will certainly arouse suspicion."
Sverdlovsk elbow-crawled backward down the face of the slope. Before following him, Grant passed the binoculars to Kane so he could take a quick look at their objective. At this distance, the walls of Karakoto looked like no more than a dark ridge rising on the terrain. There was nothing sinister or awe-inspiring about it. At the bottom of the slope waited the convoy of a covered truck and Boro's mounted men. They had left the airbase before sunrise and traveled across the barren landscape all day, with only a single noon break to rest and water the horses. Sverdlovsk lowered the tailgate of the truck. Stacked inside were over a dozen wooden crates of varying sizes. The three troopers who had flown with them from Russia guarded the cargo with watchful eyes, fingers on the triggers of their AKMs. The three Americans joined Sverdlovsk at the rear of the wag.
"From here on out, you will have to trust me unquestioningly. One misstep will get us all killed."
"So you told us last night, but you've yet to earn that trust."
"It's too late now, Kane. You either trust me or you don't."
"We don't."
"What can I do at this point?"
"Give us back our weapons and equipment."
"I apologize. Why didn't you ask me last night?"
"We figured you had other things on your mind."
"Very true. I appreciate your compassion."
"That's one item you did earn."
Sverdlovsk reached into the truck and pulled out the leather satchel. Using the open tailgate as a table, Sverdlovsk unsnapped the catches on the case and withdrew their possessions. They inspected them and found them to be in working order. Grant and Kane took off their coats so they could strap the sin-eaters to their forearms and attach the combat harnesses. Bridget swept the area with her rad counter.
Mid-range orange reading in the valley. This place is very warm.
If it wasn't for the medicines I provided, most of the Tushegun's followers would be dead by now. As it is, a great number of them are sick.
From the bottom of the satchel, he produced a pair of fur caps, duplicates of his own, decorated with silver discs. He thrust them toward Kane and Grant.
Wear these from now on. Don't speak. Just glare, and everyone will assume you are my lieutenants.
My color is not exactly the Russian soldier's standard, you know.
All the better. You'll intimidate the superstitious Tartars, since black is one of their high or holy colors. Are you ready, my dear?
Bridget slipped the Mauser into a coat pocket and heaved herself up onto the tailgate.
No, but it's too late to back out now.
No, it isn't.
We went over it last night. If Boro recognized me, then the Tushegun or some of his followers will too.
Bridget climbed into the back of the truck. A trooper lifted open the lid of a long crate and she stepped into it. The night before, Svedlovsk had ordered the construction of a specially designed box. The sides were slatted, and the edge of the lid bore nail heads all around, but it was actually secured by concealed hinges and a latch on the inside. After she lay down in the crate, the troopers carefully packed small items around her body, not only to add weight, but to keep her from rolling from side to side when the box was unloaded and carried. The lid was lowered, and Kane listened for the click of the inner latch. The night before, he had rattled off a litany of problems with the plan. Her crate could be buried beneath the others out in the open, where she would freeze to death, or opened before it was conveyed into the city. Bridget had listened calmly to his objections, proclaimed them reasonable, then quoted him his own 1%er bit of doggerel. Sverdlovsk lifted the tailgate back into its upright position.
A very brave young woman. She shares my Lenya's strength of spirit.
Kane was too considerate to mention that Bridget could very well join Lenya's spirit if anything happened to upset the plan. Sverdlovsk and Kane climbed into the cab. Grant took up his position on the driver's side running board. His job was to look fierce and forbidding.
You may feel a little at sea since I will be speaking either in Russian or their own dialect. Whatever happens, you must follow my lead. Do as I do.
And what happens if you get your head chopped off?
In that case, comrade, I give you leave to follow your own impulses.
Flanked by Boro's riders, the truck rolled across the sandy terrain toward the mouth of the valley. Before they had covered half the distance, a warrior astride a piebald pony galloped out to meet them. He stood in his stirrups and waved.
Tushegun, Yadamal, Sang Ba Obergon.
Yabulduta, Esigi Kelele, Sang Ba Obergon Ebedi.
The warrior reined his horse to a halt, and his dark, slitted eyes fixed on Grant as the vehicle rumbled past him. He was a small but powerfully built man. Hanging onto the side mirror, Grant returned the stare, noting that the Mongol's swart face looked both brutal and hungry. Just beneath the matted fur trim of his leather skullcap, he saw a faint, round scar high on his forehead. Grant turned his stare into a glare, and the warrior's eyes flicked aside.
He wanted to know where Sung and Obergon were, saying that the Tushegun would be displeased by their absence.
What did Boro say to him?
Basically, fuck you, I'm still their father. The rest was what we'd agreed upon, that they'd fallen ill back at the base. Since there is so much sickness in the camp, it's not an unusual excuse.
They passed a small flatbed truck parked near some thorny underbrush. Sverdlovsk pointed to it.
That's the wag I allowed Bridget to appropriate. It looks in working condition, and that's good. I hate filling out lost ordnance paperwork.
As they rolled into the valley, they smelled odors of smoke, grease, and roasting food. At the engine sounds of the truck, women in long, gathered skirts, their bodies underneath stout and squat, rushed for the safety of their yurts, herding their children in front of them. Smoke-stained faces peered out from behind tent flaps as they passed by, skirting cooking fires and makeshift corrals holding horses and sheep. In a larger pen, they saw a number of people who lay or huddled on the ground. Their bodies were distorted, scabbed, the eyes covered by milky films. Some people seemed to be one single festering sore, pocked with rupturing, vile-smelling boils. Grant looked away in disgust, recognizing the symptoms of advanced rat poisoning. The camp of the Tushegun seemed more like a huge open-air death ward than the home of his adoring followers. It seemed to take a very long time to drive through the valley encampment, and Kane worried about Bridget in her crate, even though he knew there were sufficient spaces between the wooden slats to allow free breathing. At the far end of the valley, a half-dozen riders galloped forth from the direction of the city walls. The men wore black tunics, and their faces were smeared with black grease. When they drew closer, they gaped at Grant.
These men will escort us to the Tushegun's yurt in the city. They're warrior priests, the Avenging Lama's bodyguards. They wear the holy colors of Karabatur himself. They will not search us, Grant, because they think you're one of them.
Maybe I will be if this plan goes sour.
The 2 miles of terrain between the end of the valley and the city walls was bleak and black, as if it had been exposed to open flames. Powdery sand and ash floated up in the wake of the truck's passage, irritating Grant's throat. He and Kane had seen rad-blasted landscapes like this before, hell zones where the invisible poisons had leached all life away. The city walls loomed nearer, and they were more massive than Kane or Grant had expected. They were made of blocks of a dead black stone that reflected no trace of the setting sun. The walls loomed 20 feet high, and sections were so eroded they had fallen altogether. The great pillars of the gate reared from the ground, and beyond them were roofless arches and crumbling buildings containing nothing but empty legend. A few yurts were scattered around the outer perimeter of the walls. Karokoto was enormous, and Kane tried to picture it in its past glory, blazing splendidly with light and color and roaring with life. He visualized the barbaric chieftains from the wild steppes coming here to bend their knees in the presence of the Black Hero. And now there was only silence and gathering twilight to fill the streets and shattered buildings. A broad avenue ran inward from the gate, and the truck followed it. The avenue widened inside the walls, opening into a vast courtyard filled with the wreck and ruin of Karabatur's palace. Great blocks of basalt and granite had fallen from the building, and the main vault of the roof was open to the sky. But the inner arches still stood, and fragments of fretted galleries stretched to nowhere. Broken statues lay in the dust, their features mutilated by the merciless hand of time. The carved eye sockets were filled with grit. The effort to clear away centuries of accumulated sand and detritus had to have been monumentally backbreaking. Despite himself, Kane felt a grudging admiration grow for the Tushegun and his devoted followers. Sverdlovsk steered the truck around a white yurt in the middle of the courtyard. A sear-faced man, armed with a brace of automatic pistols, stood in front of it, seeming to pay no attention to the vehicle.
Inside that tent is the well, which leads down to the vault. It is always guarded.
In front of the palace ruins, they saw 7 large yurts, bigger than any they had passed in the valley, arranged in a circle. In the center of the cluster squatted the largest of the domes. It was black, decorated with petroglyphs in crimson. On either side of it stood long wooden poles 10 feet tall. Red and black banners were wrapped around the shafts, the loose ends fluttering in the breeze. Affixed to the very tops of the poles were human heads, the necks severed cleanly. Though the sagging, immobile faces were spotted with dried blood, Kane and Grant recognized Adrian and Davis.
Sons of bitches. I'm glad Bridget can't see them.
The black-garbed riders halted their animals and dismounted. A man took the horse's reins and led them to a rope picket line off to one side. Grant stepped down from the running board as Boro and his men climbed from their saddles, turning their horses over to the men with the blackened faces. Boro walked toward the center yurt, while Kane, Sverdlovsk, and Grant waited beside the truck. It was warmer within the city walls than in the valley, and the air smelled cleaner. The tent flap opened, pulled from the inside. Boro poked his head inside to speak to someone in the interior. Then he turned and beckoned the 3 men to join him. Moving single file, they ducked their heads and entered the yurt. It was surprisingly well lit. The floor covered with carpets bearing elaborately woven geometric forms. One such design that Kane saw repeated was a red triangle bisected by 3 vertical lines. The light shone from several small square panels hanging from the domed roof of the tent. They exuded a steady blue-yellow glow. Dimly lit by the panels, the Tushegun leaned forward on his seat of cushions at the shadowy back of the yurt. Grant and Kane tried hard not to stare. The Tushegun was dressed colorfully in high boots of dyed red leather, blue leggings, and a black silk tunic decorated with dragons worked in golden thread. Red gauntlets encased his hands and forearms. A fur-trimmed cloak of green fell from his shoulders to the backs of his ankles. The green complemented the smooth mask of carved jade covering his face. He made an imposing, dramatic figure, but there was something not quite right about him. The Tushegun appeared taller than his fellow Mongols, with a broad chest and equally broad shoulders, but shorter legs, which was often the case with this body type. Yet even at a glance, his legs and arms seemed disproportionate compared to his torso. Overall, the impression was that there was something unnaturally out of balance in his build. On the index finger of his right hand glinted a massive silver ring that covered an entire joint. It resembled a snarling, ferocious dragon's head, fanged jaws agape. A necklace of small gold beads hung from his neck to his waist. Around his hips was a tasseled cord of interwoven rainbow colors. Attached to the cord was a long, sheathed saber, the scabbard set with dozens of multi-hued gems. Behind the curved eyelets, a glittering gaze studied them. Sverdlovsk dropped to one knee, and after a brief hesitation, Kane and Grant followed suit, ducking their heads and sticking out their tongues as the Russian had earlier instructed them to do. Only Boro didn't kneel in submission or respect. Kane assumed that as the Tushegun's father, he was exempt from the prerequisite groveling.
Eskige, Makoski!
It was apparent to Kane that the son was expecting the father to humble himself before him. Boro was having none of it, and he shook his head violently in way of reply. The hands of the man in the mask caressed the pommel of his saber. They were small hands, slender and almost delicate in shape. The green mask shifted away from Boro's angry face. Wordlessly, he pointed toward the door flap of the yurt. Wheeling, Boro stamped his way out of the tent, violently flinging aside the door flap.
You may rise.
Sverdlovsk jumped to his feet. Grant and Kane had no idea what the Tushegun had just said in Russian, but they followed suit. They stood together on the right side of Sverdlovsk.
Who are these two? Who are they?
Gifts, Avenging Lama. They cannot understand our words, so I will speak candidly. They came from across the sea, like the other interlopers. I tricked them into accompanying me.
And what do you expect me to do with these gifts of yours?
Sverdlovsk cast a warm grin toward Grant and clapped Kane on the shoulder.
They have come to douse the sacred flame, so I would suggest you kill them.
And what do you wish in return?
Only your trust. If you prefer, I will kill them for you.
No, I think not. Bautu was premature in killing the other two outsiders. I think it would be wise to let the dragon kiss these two.
Kane and Grant, not understanding a word, smiled deferentially at the Tushegun.
Seize them!
Sverdlovsk immediately dropped to his knees as if he had been pulled by a string. Grant and Kane, after a mystified moment, did the same. They resisted the impulse to look around, even as they heard the rustle of the tent flap and the sounds of scuffling feet. They knew a number of men had entered the yurt. They could smell their rank, unwashed animal odor. Kane's point man sense triggered a distant alarm, and he began to raise his head. Immediately, they were bowled over by a swarm of bodies, hitting them from behind. Hands grabbed at them, knees dug painfully into the smalls of their backs. Their arms were yanked upward, and loops of rawhide slipped around their wrists.
Shit!
Instinctively, Kane stiffened his wrist tendons, hand ready to receive the weight of the Sin Eater. His hand felt nothing but air, and he realized in an angry, humiliating rush that Sverdlovsk had sabotaged either the electric cable motor or the tension actuator. The two men fought and wrestled, but the five black-garbed, black-faced men were very strong. The smallest of them was an equal match for either one of them in sheer muscular power. Kane managed to launch a back kick, and he took savage pleasure in the shiver of impact running up his leg as his foot landed solidly. Ah! A moment later, he received a kick on the jaw. Ugh. The floor spun crazily around and the light dimmed. Tasting blood, he was only slightly aware of a strip of leather being forced over his head and face. Hard hands clutched his coat and dragged him up to his knees. Both he and Grant now had leather collars around their throats. They were cinched tight by rawhide leashes, which allowed just enough air to ward off unconsciousness. Loops of plated leather bound their wrists. When Kane's vision cleared, he saw one of the black-faced bodyguards sitting against the hide wall, trying to staunch the flow of blood from a flattened nose. The other five men stood behind them, short-bladed swords in their fists. Sverdlovsk stood next to the Tushegun, gazing down sorrowfully.
It had to be done, comrades.
Survival and success, right?
I'm glad you understand.
Grant strained against the hands gripping him, and a man gave the leash a sharp tug. When the choking pressure relaxed, Grant glared at Sverdlovsk.
You son of a bitch. This is what you and Lenya had planned for us all along. Sacrifice us to curry this masked asshole's favor.
It is what I had planned, true enough. Lenya opposed my opportunism, so do not think ill of the dead. She was always more like her mother than myself. Lenya was interested in all of you and respected your courage. She was strangely attracted to you, Kane. With her passing, I see no reason not to revive the original strategy. It is very sound.
What about Baptiste?
That's the simple beauty of it. Her part of the operation will continue without alteration. I only need one of you to identify the items in the vault, and inasmuch as she seems the most intelligent of the three of you, she will serve my purposes adequately.
What happens to her afterward?
To employ your vernacular, afterward will have to be played by ear.
What happens to us? Do we end up as porch posts, like Adrian and Davis?
Surprisingly enough, no. At least not right away. The Avenging Llama has other plans for you. The Kiss of the Dragon.